I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi everybody, welcome back to Private Education. I'm Ashley. Andrea isn't here because she is in Los Angeles, sunning herself beside her boyfriend's pool. I am not jealous at all. And today we have a somewhat of a serious topic, actually. And it's not something I have personal experience with, but it's something I have actually been unfortunate enough to witness in the past. And that topic is narcissism. Now, narcissism and vanity are often conflated. So to be clear, this is not about someone who like loves a selfie or talks about themselves too much or hasn't ever met a mirror they didn't like. This is about narcissistic personality disorder. And I, like I said, I'm in no way an expert at all. But like you, probably, I'm very interested in this as a topic. And so I have got an expert here with me today. Hazel Larkin is my guest. Welcome, Hazel.
Hello, Aisling. Thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. Thank you for joining us. I'll let you do a proper introduction to yourself, I guess. But just to start, Hazel has 3 degrees. You have a degree in psychology and sociology, an MA in sexuality studies. You have a degree in international human rights law, and you've just finished your PhD in transgenerational trauma and child sexual abuse. And actually, just before we kind of start, I want to give a bit of a trigger warning here just for sexual abuse, trauma, and narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD, which I think is probably what we'll refer to it as from now on, because narcissistic personality disorder is quite a mouthful. So Hazel, yeah, if you want to start by just giving a bit of an introduction about you and what you do and how kind of NPD has revealed itself in your life.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for that introduction, Aisling. You'd think from that I'd know what I was talking about. But I also have personal experience of NPD. And I think that, first of all, what I want to say is that it sounds a lot like we're diagnosing it at a distance. And people will sometimes say to me, but hang on a second, first of all, you're not qualified to diagnose anybody. Mm-hmm. And second of all, how can you put a diagnosis on somebody that they don't necessarily want to accept? Or, you know, where does that come from? So my answer to that is that while I can't definitively say, oh, that person has NPD, what I can definitively say is their behavior is the behavior that highlights a person who has NPD. These are the quote unquote symptoms or the signs or the behaviors associated with NPD. And also the other thing is that so few people who actually have narcissistic personality disorder wander off and get themselves diagnosed. Yeah. So it's one of those that is very difficult to necessarily to definitively say that person has NPD. But what we can definitively say from our experiences of them and from our observations of them, that they present with a lot of the behaviors that we would associate with NPD. So that's kind of my, not my workaround, but my position you know, diagnosing people.
Yeah, because I would, like you said, I would imagine, I mean, it's very, I would imagine it's very difficult to convince a narcissist that they are a narcissist. So it's, you know, like, how can you, like that, how can you definitively say, yes, this person is that? But like, I was reading earlier on the DSM-5, the kind of diagnostic manual that professionals use to diagnose mental health disorders. Like, they have a list of kind of characteristics of NPD. And they say that you need, I think there's like maybe 9 or 10 on it, I think, and you need half of them, you need 5 or 6 to kind of say, well, this person more than likely has NPD. But like, again, even that, even the kind of, not that it's scientific, but even the medical diagnosis is a little bit vague, you know?
Well, it is, yes. You're quite right about that. And I think that there is, there's a couple of things that strike me about the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and their, you know, casting a wide net, if you like. Mm-hmm. I also, like you, have a bit of skepticism around that particular publication because it can sometimes diagnose based on cultural norms. You know, I'm reminded that we're on the DSM-5 now, and in the DSM-4, homosexuality was a mental health illness, you know, a mental illness.
Of course,
illness.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It's not. So we take some of what they say with a grain of salt. And I also just wanted to point out that from my experience, which I'll come to in a second, and from my own understanding and research around NPD, it's not necessarily a mental health issue or a mental health difficulty. Because from my understanding, from my observation, from my research, there is an element of choice. And I'll come to that, you know, that okay. that we have, I'll come to that in a second. I'm just going to backtrack slightly, yeah. And explain where my own personal experience.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Because first of all, there are a number of human qualities that are actually quite healthy that might lead somebody to say, "Oh, that person is a narcissist. Oh, that person definitely is a," and they're not necessarily one or two things. Like arrogance doesn't necessarily make you a narcissist. It just makes you arrogant. Mm. You know, really high self-esteem doesn't make you a narcissist. Having huge confidence in that you are an expert in your area doesn't make you a narcissist, you know. And so you can have, there are what would be termed by the professionals as healthy narcissistic traits. You know, it's good to think well of yourself. Mm-hmm. It's good to have high self-esteem. It's good to honor the fact that you know what you're talking about when you do know what you're talking about. But the difference is that a narcissist always thinks they know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. They think the entire world is their area of expertise. Mm-hmm. They're usually wrong about that because very few of us can be experts. In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say nobody is an expert on everything.
Yeah.
So my own personal experience of NPD, unfortunately, I have quite a bit. But that will come as no surprise because my mother is a narcissist and, you know, she ticks so many of the boxes. And there are, you know, her mother was a narcissist. So there's an element of not necessarily hereditary because I'm a sociologist, really. Mm. So I'm more inclined to look at the entire culture rather than the individual. So the culture my mother would have been raised in would have been, this is what a woman is. This is what a woman does. This is how a woman treats her children. And that brings me back to the piece around the choice, because my experience of my mother was that I was the child she liked least. There was only 6 of us. And, you know, she had 4 sons and myself and my sister then as the 2 daughters. And I was, as I said, the least liked, which I, you know, didn't. I realized, but I always thought it was a problem with me. It was only really in my late 30s that I realized, actually, no, the problem is with her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't automatically dislike a baby.
Yeah.
You know, she kind of did. And has no compunction about retelling stories about how I was treated when I was a child, because she just thinks that's okay and that's what I deserved. But she was well able to shower her sons, and 2 of them in particular, with extreme love, and, you know, she favoritism. So it's not that she didn't know how to treat a child, it was that she chose which child to treat well. And there's a funny story, a number of years ago, because I've gone completely no contact with my family because they're quite toxic. Mm-hmm. And of course my mother won't address her issues, which is unfortunate, but it means that she doesn't have a relationship with me or my children. But it was it was probably about in the last 10 or 12 years that I made that decision. So when my children were very young, bearing in mind they're now 18 and 20, we were at my mother's house, performing family, if you like. Mm-hmm. One of my brothers was over from the Netherlands, where he lives with his kids, and they were, you know, constantly screaming and shouting and bickering, whatever. But she turned on my children and told my child, you know, to stop, you know, to be quiet. She was three. And outside, you know, being an exuberant child, and I said, okay, that's it, we're going now. So I wrote her an email after I had reflected, and I finished it off by saying, well, I should have known that the children of the favourite son would be the favourite grandchildren. And she rang me and she said, I got your email, and you're wrong. Isn't my favourite. Is. And I thought, that is perfect. That is such a, you know, now in hindsight now, I can say, well, that's just narcissism all over. Because clearly I knew she wasn't going to say I was her favourite, but I thought she was going to trot out that mothers don't have favourites and I love you all equally. She didn't even go there. She was like, well, of course I have a favourite, but it's not the one that you thought, because I would always have to be wrong in my mother's head.
Yes, know? Yeah.
So I left then my family home when I was 19, and got married to a psychopath who obviously had narcissistic traits. And then my second husband was also a narcissist. And I can take you through the list of why I can say that, you know, definitively now. And I would have had other relationships with men who clearly had narcissistic traits, although not necessarily narcissistic, you know, NPD.
Do you think, because obviously, you know, for the purposes of private education, I do want to talk about it in the context of like a romantic relationship or, yeah, a, you know, that kind of way. Obviously, yeah, your experience with your mother, though, do you feel, or how sure are you, I suppose, that framed or that gave, you know, that kind of led into your narcissistic relationships or your relationships, I should say, with narcissists in your kind of personal life then? Do you think that was a direct cause and effect?
I think it set the stage, because I look at my children now who are of the age of dating and having relationships. And my eldest daughter is in a really healthy relationship with a lovely guy for 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I look at it and I say, well, how on earth did you manage to get that so right when I got it so wrong? You know, and my younger daughter, who's 18, has had a number of relationships that have gone as far as they've gone. And she's still on speaking terms with her exes. Mm-hmm. She's still, you know, they still will have a drink together now and again. And you just think, how did you manage to have such positive relationships when I didn't model that for you? Mm-hmm. And it was, my therapist said to me that it wasn't so much what I modeled in terms of my own relationships, but what I showed them was acceptable, that I loved my kids so much. And they know from day one that they were loved unconditionally, and that my heart doesn't know the difference between them. Physically, they're quite different, but my heart doesn't know the difference between them. And they were never treated as anything but equal. Mm-hmm. And that means that they have a very strong bond themselves, because they were brought up with love. They were brought up to love each other. I was never, you know, fighting one, you know, pitting one against the other, because we were all, you know, this family unit, and that's how they were raised. So I see that how I treated them set them up for good relationships, and equally how I was treated kind of set me up for bad relationships, because I didn't know, I'd never been treated well. I mean, there's a history of sexual abuse and trafficking and all sorts in my background. So I didn't know what it meant to be treated well. It's not that I was stupid and I was putting up with bad behavior. It's that I didn't know what good behavior looked like. Mm-hmm. So I did fall for people, particularly I'm thinking of my second husband, who was, and I say this with heavy quotes, just a narcissist. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the key things was that he never took no for an answer. And sometimes that can just seem that it's really attractive, you know, very romantic. He's pursuing me across continents, which he did. But he was actually stalking me. Mm-hmm. You know, if I look at the legislation now, it's kind of going tick, 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 tick.
Yeah.
You know, but instead of getting a restraining order, I got a marriage certificate, because he would not take no for an answer. Okay. And he was a champion sulker. And I think that's what you also find with narcissism. It sounds a bit daft that, you know, given our cultural notion of what a narcissist is, to say, well, actually, they sulk really well. That's an emotional thing that narcissists do to manipulate people into giving them what they want. And of course, narcissists are champion manipulators. In fact, I dated a narcissist who, not for long, who was proud of the fact. He said, I'm great at getting people to do what I want them to do. And I thought, that's manipulation. That's not good. You know, that's not, you're not saying I have great negotiation techniques. You're saying I'm good at making people do what I want them to do. And he tried that with me all of the time.
And you know? So when you were kind of early days in these relationships, and you obviously kind of going through dating them and all that kind of stuff, you weren't recognizing the signs.
Not at all.
At what point in say your second marriage with the guy who's just a narcissist, at what point did you kind of go, okay, I see what's going on here? Like, when did the penny drop, like, for you? And what kind of made, you know, was there an occasion where you went, oh my God, this person is a narcissist, they have NPD?
No, it was in hindsight. It was long after I'd left him when came across, you know, through my own studies, the notion of narcissism and narcissistic personality disorder, because I had accepted kind of the cultural narrative that a narcissist is somebody who, like you said, has never met a mirror they don't like, taking it very much literally from the myth of narcissists who fell in love with themselves and then, you know, fell into the river, or died of starvation, whichever myth book you've read. But it was, I suppose, I was never comfortable in the relationship. I never felt safe and secure in the relationship, because narcissists move the goalposts all the time, and they gaslight, which, for anybody who doesn't know, they take reality. They will take a memory. For example, one very clear example, I had one of the ways that my second husband got me to agree to marry him was a promise to start a family. Now, all I had ever wanted was to be a mother, and he knew this. Because, of course, I'd given him the ammunition to shoot me with, if you like. I'd given him my personal information, because that's what we do when we're in intimate relationships. We say, well, here's a piece of me that I don't share with everybody, and here's my honesty. But you're not met with that back. That's the problem in this kind of a relationship. So I said to him, you know, that I really wanted to start a family. And he said, look, let's just get married and we can start a family straight away. And I promise you, if you're not pregnant when we get married or shortly after, we'll start proceedings for adoption. And I thought, this is great. Happy days. Because I didn't care where the baby came from. I just wanted to have a baby. Mm-hmm. And we were married maybe a week. And I brought it up. I said, you know, let's look at adoption. He turned around and goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, no, we did speak about this. We had a conversation 4 months ago. We were I was sitting here, you were sitting there. And I was able to replay for him the contents of the conversation. He said, it never happened. I said, no, it did. He said, look, there is no way I would agree to adopt a child. He was Indian. And that's only relevant because of what he said next. Because he said, look, there's no way. He said, you never know what you're getting. There could be any caste. There could be any, really, my goodness, we might end up adopting a Muslim. And I just went, I can't believe that we're having, what? I hadn't realized he was castist. I hadn't realized he was anti-Muslim until after I married him. But anyway, but it was, it did cause me to question, because he was as adamant that the conversation hadn't taken place as I was that it had taken place. And I started to question my own sense of reality. And it was like, I'm sure we had that conversation. He said, no, we didn't. And that was just one very specific and very important conversation. But it would happen along other things. I'd say, you know, he'd be 2 hours late home from the pub and I'd have the dinner ready and I wasn't allowed to eat without him. So I'd be starving. And I'd be like, you said you'd be home by 9. And he goes, no, I didn't. I said I'd be home by 11. No, you said, why would I say I'd be home at 9 o'clock? I didn't finish work till 7. I'm hardly going to just go out for 2 pubs. You know, and it is that thing of just shaking the foundations of what you feel is your reality.
Yeah. And when you say, just sorry, Hazel, to interject there, but when you say you weren't allowed to eat without him, was that, did he like impose kind of rules or? Yeah. And is that part of his narcissism? Or was that part of his narcissism?
Absolutely. It's a control thing. He controlled everything. Literally, when I ate, what I wore, what time I got up at, what time I went to bed at, who I was allowed to speak to, whether or not I was allowed to go to a friend's birthday party. And it was never, oh, you're not allowed to go. It was like, oh, really? You're going to their birthday party? Well, you're not that close to that person anyway. Well, that's for me to decide. But anyway.
I see. It wasn't outright like, here's a list of rules, but it was more manipulation. Yeah. Okay.
It was more manipulation and it was more insidious than that. Mm-hmm. And he was a lot older than I was. And at the time he was slightly more educated than I was, so he would throw that in my face all the time. Was like, look, I know more, I've been around more, I'm older, I've traveled more, I have, you know, I have a degree, blah blah blah. And it was just, how does any of that matter when what we're talking about is where we're going to go for dinner, or whether or not I am allowed to go to my friend's party, do you know? So they don't take no for an answer, and they can never accept that they're wrong. You'll never get an apology from a narcissist. So don't ever expect one, because it won't happen.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the part of that then is that they can never accept responsibility when things don't go their way. You know, as a very clear example, as I said, my husband was Indian, and he was, if he applied for a job and didn't get it, it's because they were racist, not because his work wasn't good enough or because he wasn't a good fit. It was just like, oh no, they're racist. Or if he didn't get a pay rise that he wanted, it was because, you know, if he was white, he'd have got it. It was never, well, you just don't deserve it, or we're in a recession and the money isn't there, or whatever. It was always somebody else's fault. And like that, also the overinflated sense of self-importance. There was no one in the world more important than Sridhar, in his own mind anyway. And they always believed that they deserve better than they have. You know, like the job thing. Well, I have this job and it's grand, but I should be running the agency, or I should be. The problem is that I'm a tortured genius. No, the problem is you're an alcoholic with narcissistic personality disorder. That's the second problem. You know,
I have very limited experience with narcissistic personality disorder, but someone from the past, shall we say, I'm going to be deliberately vague here, that I believe had NPD. Someone I know, I wasn't someone I was in a relationship with, but it was someone I knew. And I one of the things that kind of was a characteristic of it to my mind anyway, was that this person was always telling lies, firstly, like extensively, and was very uneducated. But now, I didn't know this at the time, obviously, but they were very they had not even finished school, I don't think, and yet had told everyone in their life that they had multiple degrees, that they had like so much qualification, so much life experience, so many jobs, so many, like, this person, to speak to them, they must have lived 10 lives, because they had worked in so many industries and had so much experience and so much varied experience, and they told people that they had this incredibly important role in an organization. And I remember, like, I was so impressed by the person, and I was so like, this is, you know, this is amazing. And they were actually weirdly humble about it, right? So, like,
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You know, initially I wasn't like, okay, this person is, like, you know, full of self-importance, or they're being very grandiose here. They were actually quite humble about their achievements, and yet still managed to get across that they had all these achievements. And obviously, you know, years later, it transpired that absolutely none of that was true. And it was all completely made up and false and just lies and lies and lies. So I'm interested in the kind of the lying aspect of narcissism, because looking at the list of kind of traits, I remember thinking, okay, lying is obviously going to be next. Lying must be next. And it wasn't on the list. It was all this stuff about, like, self-importance, preoccupation with, like, power and success, A need for admiration, a sense of entitlement, arrogance, like you said earlier, envy, or a belief that other people are envious of what they have. And like, I was looking for just like dishonesty, like lying, just pathologically lying. And it wasn't on the list. And yet, do you feel like excessive and contrived lies are part of NPD?
Absolutely. And every narcissist I know has been a liar. And it's not just, I mean, we all look, you know, to be honest, we all tell little white lies. It's like, you know, if I'm running late, I won't necessarily say, oh gosh, you know, I just, you know,
I'm just
lost track of time.
Yeah.
I'll kind of go, oh my goodness, traffic, you wouldn't believe, blah, blah, blah. And and that's a kind of what we can call maybe a social lie. Mm-hmm. It's to protect the other person as much as to protect ourselves. The narcissist will lie exactly what you said about their achievements. My mother does that all the time. She pretends that she has qualifications and experience that she doesn't have. And I remember listening to her kind of going, what are you talking about? That's just, you know, very specifically, somebody I know was showing her a list of, they were starting a new course and they said, oh, look at these interesting modules. Have you heard of this and that? And my mother looked at me and went, oh, of course I have. Sure, I've taught most of them. And I thought, no, you haven't, you liar. You're not a teen. You know, and it was just so blatant. But the other thing is that the people who don't have NPD, we take people at face value. Mm-hmm. You don't sit around kind of going, oh, really? Can I see your certificates then, please, before I leave?
Yeah.
When you don't lie yourself, you don't expect other people to tell lies. And it can come as quite a shock when you realize actually they were lying the whole flipping time.
And do you think, or in your experience, do you think that people with NPD, in particular your ex and, you know, other people that you've been in relationships with, like, do they genuinely believe what they're saying? Like, genuinely, and this is why I suspect at the time, because I have always thought myself a good judge of character. I've always thought that I'm good at, you know, recognizing when people are being dishonest, or recognizing when there's something off with someone. And I did not sense that from this person at all. And I looking back on it, I was thinking, well, maybe it was because they so genuinely believed that what they were saying was the case, mm-hmm. that I couldn't sense the dishonesty because they genuinely believed it. So how could I sense dishonesty if they thought they were telling the truth? What do you think of that?
Well, what I think is they knew they weren't telling the truth, but they were so invested in having you believe it that they were very credible.
Okay.
That would be my thought on it, that there are, you know, there are fantasists who make up stories and they absolutely believe them in the moment. The narcissist knows they're lying. They know they're exaggerating. They know that they are bigging themselves up, because again, it comes back to feeding into their notion of themselves as being so important. Mm. And it's like, well, how would an important person speak about this? Well, because I am an important person, I will speak about it this way. But, you know, they're only important in their own heads. God love them.
Yeah. And just so kind of, if someone that's listening to this is in a relationship or starting to date someone, or it like in a new relationship or starting to date someone, and is kind of how, if there's been any kind of weird, you know, that doesn't seem right, or, you know, someone has like that is only 25 and yet apparently has 4 degrees and has worked for 10 years in 5 different industries. And like, what kind of things would you, like, if you were talking to your 20-year-old, what things would you say? Here, this is what to look out for.
Yeah, one of the first things to look out for is the love bombing, which is, you know, the gifts that seem a bit inappropriate for how early in the relationship it is.
Okay.
You know, it just seems a bit OTT, but then part of you thinks, gosh, are they just really kind? Are they just a really nice person? Why am I second guessing this? I'll always say, check in with your gut. Does it feel right? Does this feel, you know, warranted? You know, how am I feeling about this? Even if you can't put language on it straight away, that you're, you know, if you can tune into your gut and see what that's saying, because there is this cycle of love bombing and then neglect, if you like. So a narcissist is more likely to ghost you than anyone else, for example, because they just kind of go, oh, well, I'm bored of that toy now, I'm moving on. And because they haven't emotionally invested, you know, they don't care that you have.
Okay.
Or doesn't occur to them that you have. But then if you call them on it, they might actually just go, oh, actually, maybe I will play with that toy again. And they'll come back and be like, no, honey, I'm sorry I wasn't interested. I was actually in the hospital because I had this infection, but I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want you to worry. And you kind of go, okay, that's kind of plausible. Oh, okay, we'll run with that. And it's only really when there's been so many of these instances that you go, wait a second, for real? So it is, and also if, when you question them, if they become very defensive, that's a good marker.
Okay.
Because it's an idea of, you know, if you, in all innocence, if you kind of say, oh, really? Well, how can you have been in, you know, hospital in Dublin when you told me you're going to Dubai? And you're just innocently asking because you're confused yourself. And they suddenly turn around and kind of go, sorry, are you accusing me of something? I was in Dublin first and then I went to Dubai, and the lies just get worse. And
okay,
but if it
yeah.
is a defensive thing rather than, oh gosh, no, I know why you'd be confused. What actually happened was I was supposed to go to Dubai, but I couldn't because I was sick. And you kind of go, all right, go. Do you know, it's that defensiveness that makes you, as the person on the receiving end, just stop asking questions because you're afraid of what you'll be met with.
Mm-hmm. And is it a case of, you know, like there are so many traits that you could look out for. There's so many red flags that you could look out for if you were in the early stages of a relationship, or at, I guess, any stage of a relationship with a narcissist. But is there something that kind of, I mean, I don't know, a real kind of, okay, this is bad.
Well,
this is, because like arrogance or telling a few white lies, or, you know, I'm trying to think, is there anything that's kind of cut and dried, this is not a good sign, I should probably move away from this person, whether it's NPD or whether it's just, you know, bad.
Yeah, I think, well, there are a couple of things. I mean, apart from what we've said already, you know, they don't take no for an answer, they never accept they're wrong, they don't take responsibility when things don't go their way. But that overinflated self of sense of self-importance, the love bombing is a really good sign.
Okay.
You know, to watch out for the idea that, and also the fact that they have no interest in anything or anyone that doesn't directly impact or affect them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have found that what I was doing, my work, my study, my day-to-day living, was of no consequence to these narcissists. They didn't want to know because it didn't directly affect them right there and then. Unless it meant that I was going to suddenly be earning a lot more money and then could treat them, you know, to the life that they felt that they were entitled to, because they think that they're entitled to a far better life than the one that they have, and a far better life than most of the people around them. They really do believe they deserve better than they have. Mm-hmm. And they resent and can get very jealous of people who appear to have what the narcissist wants, if you know what I mean. Like, if,
okay.
you know, yeah. If the next door neighbor gets a new car, they're kind of going, oh, really now, you know, that they won't be happy about it. They don't understand how to be joyful for other people, how to kind of go, I'm really happy for you.
Okay. I have a question around friendships. Okay. So if you're in a relationship with a narcissist, is it something that you would notice that their friendships are, or their friendships are quite transactional, or that they have a lot of, they've fallen out with a lot of people, or, because that's something that I have noticed in the past with that example that I was talking about previously.
Yeah.
It's like friendships serve a very specific
yeah.
purpose, and when that purpose is achieved, or if that purpose can't be achieved, the friendship is kind of left behind. Is that something that you've experienced?
Absolutely, yes. Transactional is the best word to use for how a narcissist views relationships, because it is very much, what can I get out of this?
Okay.
Not what can I give? You know, and it might be, oh, you know, they did me a good turn. They did you a good turn because they are keeping score, and they will remind you in a week or 6 months or a year or whatever, I need you to do this for me. And say, for example, what they did was they loaned you a book. Okay. A book that you couldn't get anywhere else because it was out of print or something. So they loaned you the book and you gave the book back. In a year's time, they will look for something like, you know, access to your entire library. I'm taking that as an extreme example, but they'll want to take, you know, they'll go into where your books are, and they'll take seven or eight books off the bookshelf with no intention of ever giving them back. And it'll be like, but You're forgetting my generosity. That book that you couldn't find a year ago, I gave it to you. Yeah, but you insisted on its return. They don't compute that bit. And they don't understand. They do understand. They just don't care that they're actually taking advantage of you and your kindness. And that's the other thing. Sometimes people beat themselves up. You know, I'll talk to people and they'll say, how could I have fallen for it? How could I have seen? I must be stupid. And it's not that you're stupid. It's that you are kind. And abusive people, and I include narcissists in that, prey on kind people, because a kind person will give a second or a third or indeed a fifth chance to somebody. A kind person really does want to see the best in everybody. And they, you know, we make ourselves, I suppose, vulnerable. And I don't mean that in a victim blaming way. I mean, just because, you know, people who are preyed on tend to be nice people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not stupid. You're just kind. And what do you do? Stop being kind? Well, no, because I want not a narcissist to change who I am at my core. Mm-hmm. So if that means that I run into more than my fair share of narcissists, so be it. Because it also means that I'm not excluding people who are not narcissists, but just having, you know, a hard time or who need support. So mm-hmm. that's my position on it.
Mm-hmm. If someone that's listened to this suspects that they might be in a relationship with a narcissist or someone who they think is fully ticking all the boxes for NPD, or maybe just has a couple of the kind of characteristics that we've been talking about, what ways would you, or what advice would you give them? And is it a case of just cut and run, or is it a case of, you know, you could potentially live with something like this, or like, what's the advice there?
Why would you want to live with somebody who abuses you on a daily basis, who abuses your emotions, who financially controls you and tells you what you can and can't do? I remember after leaving my husband, just sitting down and kind of going, oh God, I feel like myself again. And it was just marvelous, because so much of me had been buried and muted and taken from me because he wouldn't put up with it. That when I escaped, and to be honest, I only left because his violence increased. And I at that stage I'd had my daughter, and I just thought, I can't bring her up in a, you know, in a home like this. So I left. But that was, for me, that was the breaking point or the turning point. But if I'd recognized the other symptoms as being abusive, I don't know that I'd have stayed. So I don't think anybody should stay with a narcissist. The other thing is, it's so few people who have NPD will actually seek help, as we were saying earlier. So they're not going to go for marriage counselling or couples counselling. They're not even going to go and see a therapist, because as far as they're concerned, there's nothing wrong with them. So why would they spend money talking to somebody when they're perfect?
Yeah. So I suppose, like, if you're with someone who actually is a narcissist, you're fighting a losing battle in a sense.
You're on a hiding to nothing. I would say get out as soon as you can. And get a therapist who can help you put the pieces of yourself back together. And I would particularly suggest that you get somebody who actually is versed in working with people who are in or leaving narcissistic relationships, if at all possible. There aren't many of them around, but there are a few in Ireland. Because it's important that they can understand quickly and see clearly to the point of the relationship that you are in, and help you put supports and scaffolding in place for yourself to leave.
Mm-hmm. And is someone who's in a relationship who is a narcissist necessarily violent, or is that something else? As in, like, if someone is listening and they feel like they're in an abusive relationship, but it hasn't become physically abusive, does that mean, no, this person isn't a narcissist, they haven't been violent, or do they go hand in hand or no?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I think there's probably only been one narcissist that I was involved with who wasn't physically violent. But that, just because there isn't physical violence in the relationship, doesn't mean that the emotional violence, the financial violence, the coercive control, all of that is violence and it's abuse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just because there are no visible bruises doesn't mean that you're not in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And really get help. I mean, even if you're thinking, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, give a call to Women's Aid and say, look, you know, maybe I'm wondering, maybe I'm in a relationship with somebody who's a narcissist. This is how they behave. And they can help you figure that one out for yourself as well. You know, there are, you don't necessarily have to be definitively sure that this is what you're living in, but if the type of relationship that you're living in, but if any of the conversation that you and I are having here today, Aisling, is striking alarm bells for anybody, or if there are any red flags being waved, or if suddenly you're finding that you're able to put language on how you've been feeling, or that there is something here in this conversation has been pinpointed, I would say don't ignore that. Explore it a bit more. And you know, maybe your partner isn't a narcissist, but maybe they are, and you're better off knowing, because then once you have information, you can make a decision about what you want to do with that information.
Yeah. And you said earlier on that one of the kind of the big things that narcissists do in relationships is that gaslighting thing. Mm-hmm. So for someone who's listening who thinks, okay, yeah, maybe that's what happened, but even if you're feeling, because like gaslighting is designed, I suppose, to confuse you and to make you feel like you don't know what you're talking about, and make you feel like, well, actually, I didn't hit you that time, or well, actually, I haven't been controlling your finances, or I never said you couldn't go to that party, or I never said you couldn't wear that dress, or I never said, you know, if someone is feeling that, if they have that like kind of brain fog caused by gaslighting, and maybe this is the first time they've realized that that's what's happening, would you say to go and speak to someone and try and get a bit of clarity for yourself and just give examples of, you know, things that have happened?
Yes, I would. I would also get very good at recording things, either on audio or even in writing. Start to keep a journal. And also bear in mind that they don't start off at the extreme. You know, a partner who has the potential to be abusive won't walk up to you on the first date and smack you in the face, because then there won't be a second date. But in a year or in 18 months, that same person could have their hands around your throat telling you how much they effing hate you and how they're going to kill you. You know, so I would say that with a narcissist, it won't start off with them saying you can't wear that. But it may start off with them saying something like, oh, that color really suits you, or more likely, that color does nothing for you, or that skirt is too short. You know, I don't think it's appropriate for this particular function. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, this person is really interested in how I look, and they want me to look well, and this is great. And then it moves on to them saying, look, I'll just go through your wardrobe and take out the stuff that just doesn't suit you. To them then saying, no, you don't go clothes shopping on your own. It's better if I go with you. And then to them just not allowing you, and I say that again with quotes, to go shopping yourself, but deciding themselves what they are going to buy for you and what you will be allowed to wear. Do you know? So it's very subtle, and there's a buildup, and it doesn't necessarily start with something that makes you go, oh, good God, you can't speak to me like that. It's very subtle, and there's a gradual buildup.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the gradual buildup is, I mean, like, it, you know, that's exactly how it works, and that's how it happens to someone who is otherwise, like, I mean, I'm thinking of myself and I'm going, if anyone tried to tell me what to wear, you know, but I can understand how little by little by little, if you think you love someone and you're in a relationship and you think you're happy, whether that's a false sense of happiness or otherwise, you know, it can over the course of time escalate, and you don't even realize by the time you've gotten to, well, I'm just going to buy your clothes for you, you know, and that's obviously kind of a mild example of coercive control, but like an example nonetheless, you know, and something that happens quite frequently. By the time you get to that point, that seems normal. That's your new normal. Yeah. So if anyone's listened to this and has, you know, is at any point along that kind of path and is just not even, you know, just looking to query it, just looking to get a bit more information, or have a conversation with someone impartial who has a bit of expertise, who can say, well, actually, no, that's not normal. Because again, you can be so clouded in these things that you don't realize. So Hazel would advise, obviously, speaking to the Women's Aid. What I might do actually, Hazel, is I might get you, between us, I think we could come up with a list of websites or numbers that people that listen can call if they want to have a chat with someone with a bit of expertise.
They can also talk to me. You know, I'm around. I have a website that people can contact me through.
Of course.
And, you know, I won't necessarily tell you what you want to hear, but and I think the first thing to do is to check in with yourself again and think, well, feel your feelings around it, rather than try and rationalize it in your head and kind of go, no, they're just looking after me. No, they were just tired. No, they didn't mean it. No, they were just snappy because they were hangry. How did that make you feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's key.
But the other thing is that sometimes it can be difficult to actually hear your gut because you've been trained to ignore it mm-hmm. by an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So
what I was kind of thinking is, if you're in an abusive relationship and these sorts of things are happening all the time, your gut is probably never not on high alert. You're probably always on a bit of on the edge. You're probably always feeling a little bit sick, always feeling a little bit adrenaline kind of, you know, so your gut might be masked. And so that's why a conversation with someone and just to sense check what's going on in your relationship might be a good idea.
Yeah.
Hazel, that was so interesting. And I'd love to have you back and talk a little bit more about a couple of other topics, because you Absolutely. Are so, I mean, you've so many qualifications and they're real.
I do. On my goal, I have the certificates.
And yeah, if anyone wants to chat to Hazel or find out more about her, traumarecovery.ie is her website. Are you on social media at all, Hazel? Or
I am. Yeah. I'm at Hazel K Larkin on Twitter.
Okay, great. So people can find you there and follow you. Brilliant. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us on private education. I'd love if anyone's listening, if you enjoyed the episode, drop me a message on at Private Education Podcast on Instagram, or to me on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, it's Aisling M. Keenan, and let me know if you enjoyed the episode, because obviously I want to make episodes that you love, so feedback is necessary for that. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks for all the lovely feedback from last week's episode. And until next week, stay safe, have fun, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.